Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Black Terror by Henry S. Whitehead. I woke up in the great mahogany bed of my house in Christiansted with an acute sense of something horribly wrong, something frightful tearing up my mind. I pulled myself together, shook my head to get the sleep out of my eyes, pulled aside the mosquito netting. That was better. The strange sense of horror which had pursued me out of sleep was fading now. I groped vaguely back into the dream, or whatever it had been. It did not seem to have been a dream. It was something else. I could now somehow localize it. I found now that I was listening painfully to a sustained aching sound, like a steam calliope fastened onto one high-piercing, raucous note. I knew it could not be a steam calliope. There had been no such thing on the island of Santa Cruz since Columbus discovered it on his second voyage in 1493. I got up and into my slippers and muslin bathrobe, still puzzled. Then abruptly, the note ended, cut off clean like the ceasing of the drums when the villagers were having one of their ratas back of the town in the hills. Then, and only then, I knew what it was that had disturbed me. It had been a woman screaming. I ran out into the semi-enclosed gallery, which runs along the front of my house on the Compagnie Gardée, the street of hard-pounded earth below, and looked down. A group of early-risen villagers in nondescript garb were assembled down there, and the number was increasing every instant. Men, women, small children were gathered in a rapidly tightening knot directly in front of the house, their guttural mumbles of excitement forming a contrapuntal background to the solo of that sustained scream. For the woman, there in the center, was at it again now, with fresh breath, uttering her blood-curdling, hopeless, screeching wail, a thing to make the listener wince. Not one of the throng surrounding her touched the woman in their midst. I listened to their guttural creole, trying to catch some clue to what this disturbance was about. I could catch a word of the broad patois here and there, but nothing my mind could lay hold upon. At last it came, the clue, in a childish piping treble, the clear-cut word, Jumbi. I had it now. The screaming woman believed, and the crowd about her believed, that some evil witchery was afoot. Some enemy had enlisted the service of the dreaded witch-doctor, the Papalois, and something fearful, some curse or charm, had been put on her, or someone belonging to her family. All that the word Jumbi had told me clearly. I watched now for whatever was going to happen. Meanwhile, I wondered why a policeman did not come along and break up the public gathering. Of course, a policeman, being a villager himself, would be as much intrigued as any of the others, but he would do his duty nevertheless. The old adage was as true nowadays as in the remote days of the West Indian times. You had to put a villager to drive the villagers. The woman, now convulsed, rocking backwards and forwards, seemed as though possessed. Her screams had now an undertone or cadence of pure horror. It was ghastly. A policeman at last, two policemen in fact, one of them old Kraft, once a Danish top sergeant of garrison troops. Kraft would tolerate no nonsense. He advanced, waving his truncheon threateningly, barking hoarse reproaches, commands to disperse. The group of people began to melt away in the general direction of the Sunday market, herded along by Sergeant Kraft's patrolman. Now only old Kraft and the woman who had been screaming remained, facing each other in the street below. I saw the old man's face change out of its harsh, professional, manhandling frown into something distinctly more humane. He spoke to the woman in low tones. She answered him in mutters, not unwillingly, but as though to avoid being overheard. I spoke from the gallery. "What is it, Herr Kraft? Can I be of assistance?" Old Kraft looked, recognized me, touched his cap. "Stupidness!" exploded Old Craft explanatorily. "The woman, she have had..." Old Craft paused and made a sudden, stiff, dramatic gesture, and looked at me meaningly. His eyes said, "I could tell you all about it, but not from here." "A chair in the gallery for the poor woman," I suggested, nodding to him. "Come," said he to the woman, and she followed him obediently up the outside gallery steps, while I walked across to unfasten the door at the gallery's end. We placed the woman, who seemed dazed now and kept a hand on her head, in one of my chairs where she walked slowly back and forth, whispering to herself, and Craft and I went inside the house, where I led him through to the dining room. There at the sideboard, I did the honors for my friend Sergeant Craft of the Christiansted Police. "The woman screaming awakened me half an hour early," I began, invitingly, as soon as the sergeant had been duly refreshed and had said his final skull, his eyes on mine in the Danish manner. "Yeah, yeah," returned Craft, nodding a wise old head. "She tell me the Obiman fix her right this time." This sounded promising. I waited for more. "But just what it is, I cannot tell at all," continued Craft, disappointingly, as though aware of the secretiveness which would animate a police sergeant. "Will you have another, Herr Craft?" I suggested. The sergeant obliged, ending the ceremony with another skull. This libation, as I had hoped, had the desired effect. I will spare Kraft's accent, which could be cut with a knife. What he told me was that this woman, Elizabeth Agard, lived in a village estate cabin near the central factory a few miles outside of Christiansted, had a son, one Cornelius McBean. The young fellow was what is locally known as a gallows bird. In short, a gambler, thief, and a general bad egg. He had been in the police court several times for petty offenses, and in jail in the Christians Fort more than once. But, as Craft expressed it, it ain't the thievin' that make the present difficulty, no. It was that young Cornelius McBean had presumed beyond his station and had committed the crime of falling in love with Estrella Collins, the daughter of a prosperous storekeeper in one of Christiansted's side streets. Old Collins, utterly disapproving, and his words to McBean having had no effect whatever upon that stubborn lover, had in short employed the services of a papalois to get rid of McBean. "But," I protested, "I know old Collins. I understand, of course, how he might object to the attentions of such a young ne'er-do-well, but a storekeeper like him, a comparatively rich man, to call in a papalois, it seems..." "Him?" replied Sergeant Craft, with a little significant gesture which made everything plain. "What?" said I, after thinking a little. "What particular kind of wanga has Collins had put on him?" The old sergeant gave me a quick glance at that word. It is a meaningful word. In Haiti, it is very common. It means both talisman and amulet, something that is to attract or something to repel, to defend the wearer. But here in Santa Cruz, the magic of the natives is neither so clear-cut nor, as some imagine, quite so deadly as the magic kings of the Papalois and the Hugans in Haiti's infested hills, with their thousands of voodoo altars to Ogumba Dagaris, to Dambala, to the snake of Far, dreadful Guinea. Over even so much as the manufacture of wangas, I may not linger. One cannot. The details. "It is, I think, a sweat wanga," whispered Old Craft, and went a shade lighter than his accustomed sunburned ivory. "The woman alleged," he continued, "that the boy sicken and die at noon today. For that reason, she is walking to the town early because there is no help. She desired to be well, like, just trouble resting upon her head." Craft had given me all the information he possessed. He rated a reward. I approached the sideboard a third time. "You will excuse me again, Sergeant. It is a little early in the day for me. Still, a man can't walk on one leg." The sergeant grinned at this Santa Crucian proverb, which means that a final stirrup cup is always justified, and remarked, "He should walk goot on three." After this reference to the number of his early morning refreshments, he accepted the last of these, boomed his skull, and became a police sergeant once more. "Shall I take the woman along, sir?" he inquired, as we reached the gallery where Elizabeth Agard still rocked and moaned and whispered to herself in her trouble. "Leave her here, please," I replied, "and I will see that Esmeralda finds her something to eat." The sergeant saluted and departed. "God bless you, sir," murmured the poor soul. I left her there and went to the kitchen to drop a word in the sympathetic ear of my old cook. Then I started toward my belated shower bath. It was nearly 7 by now. After breakfast, I inquired for Elizabeth Agar. She had had food and had delivered herself at length upon her sorrows to Esmeralda and the other house servants. Esmeralda's account established the belief that the young McBean had been marked for death by one of the oldest and deadliest devices known to primitive barbarism, one which, as all people know, if it will assure you, derives its sole efficacy from the psychology of fear. That fear of the occult which has stultified the minds of the villagers through countless generations of warfare against the jungle and the dominance of his fetish men and voodoo priests. As is well known to all students of African magic, portions of the human body, such as hair, the clippings of nails, or even some garment long worn in contact with the body, is regarded as having a magical connection with the body itself and a corresponding influence upon it. Portion of the shirt which have been worn next to the body and which has absorbed perspiration is especially highly regarded as a material for the making of a protective charm or amulet, as well as for its opposite, planted against a person for the purpose of doing him harm. Blood, etc., could be included in this weird category. In the case of young Cornelius McBean, this is what had been done. The Papalois had managed to get hold of one of Cornelius's shirts. In this he had dressed the recently buried body of an aged man who had died a few days before of senility. This shirt, after it had been in the coffin for 3 days and nights, had been cunningly put back for Cornelius to find and wear again. It had been supposedly mislaid. Young McBean, finding it in his mother's cabin, had worn it again. And, as if this in itself enough to cause his death from sheer terror as soon as he knew of it, was not sufficient. It had just come to the knowledge of the mother and son by the curious African method known as the grapevine root that a small wanga made up of some of Cornelius's nail parings, stubble of a week's beard collected from discarded lather after shaving, various other portions of his exterior personality had been fixed by the Christian said Papalois and buried against him. This meant that unless the wanga could be discovered and dug up and burned, he would die at noon. As he had learned of the burying of the Uwanga only the evening before, and as the island of Santa Cruz had an area of more than 80 square miles, there was perhaps one chance in some 100 trillion that he could find the Uwanga, disinter it, and render it harmless by burning. Taking into consideration that his ancestors for countless eons had given their full and firm belief to this method of murder by mental process, it looked as though young Cornelius McBean, ne'er-do-well, the island's gallows bird, aspiring admirer of a young woman somewhat beyond his station in life, according to African West Indian caste systems, was doomed to pass out on the stroke of 12 that day. That, with an infinitude of detail, was the substance of the story of Elizabeth Agar. I sat and looked at her, quiet and humble now, no longer the screaming fury she had appeared to be at that morning's crack of dawn. And as I looked at the poor soul with a dumb distressed motherhood in her dim eyes from which the unchecked tears ran down her face, it came to me that I wanted to help, that this thing was outrageous, wicked, with a wickedness far surpassing the ordinary sinfulness of ordinary people. I did not want to sit by, as it were, and allow the unknown McBean to pass out at the behest of a paid rascal or Papalois merely because unctuous old Collins had decided on that method for his exit from this life, a matter involving perhaps $15 fee to the witch doctor, the collection and burial of some bits of offal somewhere on Santa Cruz. I could imagine the young fellow livid with a nameless fear, a complex of ancient, inherited, unreasonable dreads, shivering, cowering, sickened to his dim soul by what lay ahead for him, 3 hours away, when 12 should strike, from the Christian's fort clock in the old tower by the harbor, writhing helplessly in his mind before the approach of the ghastly doom which he had brought upon himself because he had happened to fall in love with Estrella Collins, whose sleek father carried a collection plate every Sunday up and down the aisle of his place of worship. There was an element of absurdity in it all, now that I was actually sitting here looking at McBean's mother. She had given up now, it appeared, was resigned to the fate of her only son. Well, the thought of that collection plate in old Collins' pudgy storekeeper's hand reminded me of something. "What is your church, Elizabeth?" I inquired suddenly. "My English church, sir, the boy also. Him make great Chandra Madan, sir. Him gamble and perhaps a thief, but him one-time communicant, sir." An inspiration came to me then. Perhaps I could prevail upon one of the English church clergy to help. It was, when one came down to the brass tacks of the situation, a question of belief. A similar wanga, buried against me, would have no effect whatever, because to me such a means of getting rid of a person was merely the height of absurdity, like the charm-killing of the Polynesians by making them look at the reflection in a gourd of water, and then shaking the gourd, and so destroying the image. Perhaps if Elizabeth and her son could be persuaded to do their part. I spoke long and earnestly to Elizabeth. At the end of my speech, which had emphasized the superior power of divinity, when compared to even the most powerful of the African fetishes, even the dreaded snake himself, Elizabeth, her hopes somewhat aroused, I imagine, took her departure, and I jumped into my car and ran up the hill towards the English church rectory. Father Richardson, the pastor himself, a West Indian born, was at home. To him I explained the case. When I had ended, "I'm obliged to you, Mr. Canavan," said the clergyman. "If only they would realize precisely what you told the woman, that divinity is infinitely more powerful than their beliefs. I will accompany you at once. It is really the release, perhaps, of a human soul. And they come to us, clergy, over such things as a theft of a couple of coconuts." Father Richardson left me, came back in 2 minutes with a bag, and we started for Elizabeth Agard's village along a lovely shore road by the gleaming placid blue Caribbean. The estate village was surprisingly quiet when we arrived. The clergyman got out at Elizabeth's cabin, and I drove the car out of the way off the road into a rank guinea grass. I saw Father Richardson, a commanding tall figure, austere in his long black cassock, striding in at the cabin door. I followed and got inside just in time to witness a strange performance. The boy, livid and seeming shrunken with terror, cowered upon a thin blanket on a small iron bedstead. Over him towered the clergyman, and just as I came in he stooped and with a small sharp pocket knife cut something loose from the boy's neck and flung it contemptuously on the harder floor of the cabin. It landed just at my feet, and I looked at it curiously. It was a small black bag of some kind of cotton material, with a tuft of black cock's feather at its top, which was bound around by many windings of bright red thread. The whole thing was about the size of an egg. I recognized it as a protective amulet. His teeth chattering, the cold fear of death upon him, the boy protested in the guttural Creole. The clergyman answered him gravely. "There can be no halfway measures, Cornelius. When a person asks God for his help, he must put away everything else." A mutter of assent came from the woman, who was arranging a small table with a candle in the corner of the cabin. From his black bag, Father Richardson now took a small bottle with a sprinkler arrangement at its top, and from this he cast a shower of drops upon the wanga charm lying on the floor. Then he proceeded to sprinkle the whole cabin with his holy water, ending with Elizabeth, myself, and finally the boy on the bed. As the water touched his face, the boy winced visibly and shuddered, and suddenly it came over me that here was a strange matter, again I dare say a matter of belief. The change from the supposed protection of the charm, which the priest had cut away from his neck and contemptuously tossed away, to the prescribed method of the church, must have been somehow, and in some obscure mental fashion, a very striking one to the young fellow. The bottle went back into the bag, and now Father Richardson was speaking to the boy on the bed. "God is intervening for you, my child, and God's power is supreme over all things, visible and invisible. He holds all in the hollow of his hand. He will now put away your fear and take his weight from your soul, and you shall live. You must now do your part. If you would be fortified by the sacrament, you just purify your soul, penance first. Then," the boy, now appreciably calmer, nodded his head, and the priest motioned me out including the woman and his gesture. I opened the cabin door and stepped outside, closely followed by Elizabeth Agard. I left her 20 paces from her cabin, wringing her hands, her lips murmuring in prayer, while I went and sat in my car. 10 minutes later, the cabin door opened, and the priest beckoned us within. The boy lay quiet now, and Father Richardson was engaged in repacking his black bag. He turned to me. "Goodbye, and thank you. It was very good of you to bring me. But aren't you coming?" "No," this reflectively. "No, I must see him through." He glanced at his wristwatch. "It is 11:15 now. It was at noon, you said." "I'm staying with you then," said I, and sat down in a chair in the far corner of the little cabin room. The priest stood by the bedside, looking down at the boy, his back to me. The woman was apparently praying earnestly to herself in another corner out of the way. The priest stooped and looked at the limp hand and wrist in his large, firm hands, and counted the pulse, glancing at his watch. Then he came and sat beside me. "Half an hour," he murmured. Elizabeth prayed without a sound in her corner on the hard earth floor where she knelt rigidly. We sat without conversation for a long 20 minutes, during which the sense of strain in the cabin became more and more apparent to me. Abruptly, the boy's mouth fell open. The priest sprang forward towards him, seized and chafed the dull hands. The boy's head turned on the pillow and his jaws came together again, his eyelids fluttering. Then a slight spasm, perceptible through the light covering, ran through him, and breathing a few times deeply, he resumed his coma-like sleep. The priest now remained beside him. I counted off the minutes to noon. 9:07. At least 3 minutes before noon. When I had got that far, I heard the priest's deep, monotonous voice, reciting in a low tone. Listening, I caught his words here and there. He held the boy's hand while the words rolled out low and impressively. "To withstand and overcome all assaults of thine adversary, unto thee ghostly strength, and that he now prevail against thee." Then, dropping a note to my surprise, the clerical voice of this most Anglican of clergymen began to declaim the words of an old liturgical language. The words, gaining in volume with the priest's earnestness, rolled out now. I saw that we were on the very verge of noon, and looking back to the bed from my glance at my watch, I saw convulsion after convulsion shake the thin body in the bed. Then the cabin itself began to tremble in a sudden wind that had sprung up from nowhere. The dry palm fronds lashed back and forth outside, and the whistle of the wind blew under the crazily hung door. The muslin curtain of the small window suddenly billowed like a sail. Then suddenly the harsh voice of the boy. "Dambala," it said clearly, and moaned. Dambala is one of the great mysteries of the voodoo worship. I shuddered in spite of myself. But now higher and more commanding came the voice of Father Richardson, positively intoning now. Great sentences of power, formulas interposed, as he himself stood interposed between the boy and the powers of evil which seemed to seek him out for their own fell ends. The priest seemed to stretch a mantle of mystic protection over the groveling, writhing body. The mother lay prone on the dirt floor now, her arms stretched out cross-like, the last, most abject gesture of supplication of which humanity is physically capable. As I glanced down at her, I saw, in the extreme corner of the little room, something oddly shaped, projecting from a pile of discarded garments. It was now exactly noon. As I looked carefully at my watch, the distant stroke of the Angelus came resoundingly from the heavy bell of St. John's Church. Father Richardson ceased his recitation, laid back the boy's hand on the coverlid, and began the Angelus. I stood up at this, and as he finished, I plucked a sleeve. The wind, curiously enough, was gone utterly. Only the noon sun beat down suffocatingly on the iron roof of the frail cabin. Father Richardson looked at me inquiringly. I pointed to that corner under the pile of clothes. He walked to the corner, stooped, and drew out a crude wooden image of a snake. He glanced accusingly at Elizabeth, who groveled afresh. "Take it up, Elizabeth," commanded Father Richardson. "Break it in two and throw it out of the doorway." The woman crawled to the corner, lifted the thing up, snapped it in two, and then rising, her face gray with fear, opened the cabin door and threw out the pieces. We went back to the bedside, where the boy breathed quietly now. The priest shook him. He opened swimming eyes like a drunken man's.
He goggled stupidly at us. "You are alive, by the mercy of God," said the priest severely. "Come now, get up. It is well past noon. Here, Mr. Canavan will show you his watch. You are not dead. Let this be a lesson to you to leave alone what God has put outside your knowledge." The boy sat up, still stupidly, the thin blanket drawn about him on the side of the bed. "We may as well drive back now," said Father Richardson, picking up his black bag in a businesslike manner. As I turned my car to the right, just outside the estate village stone gateway, I glanced back toward the village. It swarmed with villagers, all crowding about the cabin of Elizabeth Agar. Beside me, I heard the rather monotonous voice of Father Richardson. He seemed to be talking to himself, thinking aloud, perhaps. "Creator of all things, visible and invisible." I drove slowly to avoid the ducks, fowls, pigs, pickaninnies, and burrow carts between the edge of town and the rectory. "It was," said I, as I held his hand at parting, "an experience that..." "Oh, that, yes, yes, quite. I was thinking, you'll excuse me, Mr. Canavan, of my afternoon sick calls. My curate isn't quite over that last attack of dengue fever. I have a full afternoon. Come in and have tea with us, any afternoon, about 5. I drove home slowly. A West Indian priest. That sudden wind, the little wooden snake, the abject fear in the eyes of the boy, all that had been merely in the day's work for Father Richardson, and those rather awkward, large, square hands, the hands which held the sacrament every morning. Sometimes I would get up early and go to church myself on a weekday morning, along the soft roads through the pre-dawn dusk, along with scores of soft-stepping, barefooted villagers, plodding to church in the early dawn, going to get strength, power, to fight the age-long battle between God and Satan, the snake. Here, where the sons of Ham trembled beneath the lingering fears of the primeval curse, which came upon their ancestor because he dared to laugh at his father Noah. The Temple by H.P. Lovecraft. Manuscript found on the coast of Yucatan. On August 20th, 1917, I, Carl Heinrich, Graf von Altenburg Ehrenstein, Lieutenant Commander in the Imperial German Navy and in charge of the submarine U-29, deposit this bottle and record in the Atlantic Ocean at a point to me unknown, but probably about north latitude 20 degrees, west longitude 35 degrees, where my ship lies disabled on the ocean floor. I do so because of my desire to set certain unusual facts before the public, a thing I shall not in all probability survive to accomplish in person, since the circumstances surrounding me are as menacing as they are extraordinary, and involve not only the hopeless crippling of the U-29, but the impairment of my iron German will in a manner most disastrous. On the afternoon of June 18th, as reported by wireless the U-61 bound for Kiel, we torpedoed the British freighter Victory, New York to Liverpool in north latitude 45 degrees, west longitude 28 degrees, permitting the crew to leave in boats in order to obtain a good cinema view for the Admiralty records. The ship sank quite picturesquely, bow first, the stern rising high out of the water, while the hull shot down perpendicularly to the bottom of the sea. Our camera missed nothing, and I regret that so fine a reel of film should never reach Berlin. After that, we sank the lifeboats with our guns and submerged. When we rose to the surface about sunset, a seaman's body was found on the deck, hands gripping the railing in curious fashion. The poor fellow was young, dark, and very handsome, probably an Italian or Greek, and undoubtedly of the Victory's crew. He had evidently sought refuge on the very ship which had been forced to destroy his own, one more victim of the unjust war of aggression which the English pigs, dogs, are waging upon the fatherland. Our men searched him for souvenirs and found in his coat pocket a very odd bit of ivory carved to represent a youth's head crowned with laurel. My fellow officer, Lieutenant Klenz, believed that the thing was of great age and artistic value, so took it from the men for himself. How it had ever come into the possession of a common sailor, neither he nor I could imagine. As a dead man was thrown overboard, there occurred 2 incidents which created much disturbance among the crew. The fellow's eyes had been closed, but in the dragging of his body to the rail they were jarred open, and many seemed to entertain a queer delusion that they gazed steadily and mockingly at Schmidt and Zimmer, who were bent over the corpse. The boatswain Muller, an elderly man, who would have known better had he not been a superstitious Alsatian swine, became so excited by this impression that he watched the body in the water, and swore that, after it sank a little, it drew its limbs into a swimming position and sped away to the south under the waves. Klenz and I did not like these displays of peasant ignorance and severely reprimanded the men, particularly Mueller. The next day, a very troublesome situation was created by the indisposition of some of the crew. They were evidently suffering from the nervous strain of our long voyage and had had bad dreams. Several seemed quite dazed and stupid, and after satisfying myself that they were not feigning their weakness, I excused them from their duties. The sea was rather rough, so we descended to a depth where the waves were less troublesome. Here we were comparatively calm, despite a somewhat puzzling southward current, which we could not identify from our oceanographic charts. The moans of the sick men were decidedly annoying, but since they did not appear to demoralize the rest of the crew, we did not resort to extreme measures. It was our plan to remain there where we were and intercept the liner Dacia, mentioned in information from agents in New York. In the early evening, we rose to the surface and found the sea less heavy. The smoke of a battleship was on the northern horizon, but our distance and ability to submerge made us safe. What worried us more was the talk of boatswain Mueller, which grew wilder as the night came on. He was in a detestably childish state and babbled of some illusion of dead bodies drifting past the undersea portholes, bodies which looked at him intensely and which he recognized in spite of bloating as having seen dying during some of our victorious German exploits. And he said that the young man we had found and tossed overboard was their leader. This was very gruesome and abnormal. So we confined Mueller in irons and had him soundly whipped. The men were not pleased at his punishment, but discipline was necessary. We also denied the request of a delegation headed by Seaman Zimmer that the curious carved ivory head be cast into the sea. On June 20th, Seaman Bohm and Schmidt, who had been ill the day before, became violently insane. I regretted that no physician was included in our complement of officers, since German lives are precious, but the constant ravings of the two concerning a terrible curse were most subversive of discipline, so drastic steps were taken. The crew accepted the event in a sullen fashion, but it seemed to quiet Mueller, who thereafter gave us no trouble. In the evening we released him, and he went about his duty silently. In the week that followed, we were all very nervous, watching for the Dacia. The tension was aggravated by the disappearance of Mueller and Zimmer, who undoubtedly committed suicide as a result of the fears which had seemed to harass them, though they were not observed in the act of jumping overboard. I was rather glad to be rid of Mueller, for even his silence had unfavorably affected the crew. Everyone seemed inclined to be silent now, as though holding a secret fear. Many were ill, but none made a disturbance. Lieutenant Klenz chafed under the strain and was annoyed by the merest trifles, such as a school of dolphins which gathered about the U-29 in increasing numbers, and the growing intensity of that southward current, which was not on our chart. It at length became apparent that we had missed the Dacia altogether. Such failures are not uncommon, and we were more pleased than disappointed, since our return to Wilhelmshaven was now in order. At noon, June 28th, we turned northeastward, and despite some rather comical entanglements with the unusual masses of dolphins, were soon under way. The explosion in the engine room at 2 p.m. was wholly a surprise. No defect in the machinery or carelessness in the men had been noticed, yet without warning the ship was racked from end to end with a colossal shock. Lieutenant Klenz hurried to the engine room, finding the fuel tank and most of the mechanism shattered, and engineers Rob and Schneider instantly killed. Our situation had become very grave indeed, for though the chemical air regenerators were intact, and though we could use the devices for raising and submerging the ship and opening the hatches as long as compressed air and storage batteries might hold out, we were powerless to propel or guide the submarine. To seek rescue in the lifeboats would be to deliver ourselves into the hands of enemies unreasonably embittered against our great German nation, and our wireless had failed ever since the Victory affair to put us in touch with a fellow U-boat of the Imperial Navy. From the hour of the accident till July 2nd, we drifted constantly to the south, almost without plans, encountering no vessel. Dolphins still encircled the U-29, a somewhat remarkable circumstance considering the distance we had covered. On the morning of July 2nd, we sighted a warship flying American colors, and the men became very restless in their desire to surrender. Finally, Lieutenant Klentz had to shoot a seaman named Traub, who urged this un-German act with especial violence. This quieted the crew for the time, and we submerged unseen. The next afternoon, a dense flock of seabirds appeared from the south, and the oceans began to heave ominously. Closing our hatches, we awaited developments until we realized that we must either submerge or be swamped in the mounting waves. Our air pressure and electricity were diminishing, and we wished to avoid all unnecessary use of our slender mechanical resources. But in this case, there was no choice. We did not descend far, and when after several hours the sea was calmer, we decided to return to the surface. Here, however, a new trouble developed, for the ship failed to respond to our direction, in spite of all that the mechanics could do. As the men grew more frightened at this undersea imprisonment, some of them began to mutter again about Lieutenant Klentz's ivory image, but the sight of an automatic pistol calmed them. We kept the poor devils as busy as we could, tinkering at the machinery even when we knew it was useless. Klentz and I usually slept at different times, and it was during my sleep, about 5 a.m., July 4th, that the general mutiny broke loose. The six remaining pigs of seamen, suspecting that we were lost, had suddenly burst into a mad fury at our refusal to surrender to the Yankee battleship 2 days before, and were in a delirium of cursing and destruction. They roared like the animals they were, and broke instruments and furniture indiscriminately, screaming about such nonsense as the curse of the ivory image, and the dark dead youth who looked at them and swam away. Lieutenant Klentz seemed paralyzed and inefficient, as one might expect of a soft womanish Rhinelander. I shot all six men, for it was necessary, and made sure that none remained alive. We expelled the bodies through the double hatches and were alone in the U-29. Klentz seemed very nervous and drank heavily. It was decided that we remain alive as long as possible, using the large stock of provisions and chemical supply of oxygen, none of which had suffered from the crazy antics of those swinehound seamen. Our compasses, depth gauges, and other delicate instruments were ruined, so that henceforth our only reckoning would be guesswork, based on our watches, the calendar, and our apparent drift, as judged by any object we might spy through the portholes or from the conning tower. Fortunately, we had storage batteries still capable of long use, both for interior lighting and for the searchlight. We often cast a beam around the ship, but saw only dolphins swimming parallel to our own drifting course. I was scientifically interested in those dolphins, but though the ordinary Delphinus delphis is a cetacean mammal unable to subsist without air, I watched one of the swimmers closely for 2 hours and did not see him alter his submerged condition. With the passage of time, Klentz and I decided that we were still drifting southward, meanwhile sinking deeper and deeper. We noted the marine fauna in Florida and read much on the subject in the books I had carried with me for spare moments. I could not help observing, however, the inferior scientific knowledge of my companion. His mind was not Prussian, but given to imaginings and speculations which have no value. The fact of our coming death affected him curiously, and he would frequently pray in remorse over the men, women, and children we had sent to the bottom, forgetting that all things are noble which serve the German state. After a while he became noticeably unbalanced, gazing for hours at his ivory image and weaving fanciful stories of the lost and forgotten things under the sea. Sometimes, as a psychological experiment, I would lead him on these wanderings and listen to his endless poetical quotations and tales of sunken ships. I was very sorry for him, for I disliked to see a German suffer, but he was not a good man to die with. For myself, I was proud, knowing how the fatherland would revere my memory and how my sons would be taught to be men like me. On August 9th, we spied the ocean floor and sent a powerful beam from the searchlight over it. It was a vast undulating plain, mostly covered with seaweed and strewn with the shells of small mollusks. Here and there were slimy objects of puzzling contour draped with weeds and encrusted with barnacles, which Clance declared must be ancient ships lying in their graves. He was puzzled by one thing, a peak of solid matter, protruding above the ocean bed nearly 4 feet at its apex, about 2 feet thick, with flat sides and smooth upper surfaces which met at a very obtuse angle. I called the peak a bit of outcropping rock, but Clance thought he saw carvings on it. After a while he began to shudder and turned away from the scene as if frightened, yet could give no explanation save that he was overcome with the vastness, darkness, remoteness, antiquity, and mystery of the oceanic abysses. His mind was tired, but I am always a German, and was quick to notice two things. That the U-29 was standing the deep-sea pressure splendidly, and that the peculiar dolphins were still about us, even at a depth where the existence of high organisms is considered impossible by most naturalists. That I had previously overestimated our depth, I was sure, but nonetheless we must still be deep enough to make these phenomena remarkable. Our southward speed, as gauged by the ocean floor, was about as I had estimated from the organisms passed at higher levels. It was at 3:15 p.m., August 12th, that poor Clance went wholly mad. He had been in the conning tower using the searchlight when I saw him, bound into the library compartment where I sat reading, and his face at once betrayed him. I will repeat here what he said, underlining the words he emphasized. He is calling. He is calling. I hear him. We must go. As he spoke, he took his ivory image from the table, pocketed it, and seized my arm in an effort to drag me up the companionway to the deck. In a moment I understood that he meant to open the hatch and plunge with me into the water. Outside, a vagary of suicidal and homicidal mania for which I was scarcely prepared. As I hung back and attempted to soothe him, he grew more violent, saying, "Come now. Do not wait until later. It is better to repent and be forgiven than to defy and be condemned." Then I tried the opposite of the soothing plan and told him he was mad, pitifully demented. But he was unmoved and cried, "If I am mad, it is mercy. May the gods pity the man who in his callousness can remain sane to the hideous end. Come and be mad while he still calls with mercy." This outburst seemed to relieve a pressure in his brain, for as he finished, he grew much milder, asking me to let him depart alone if I would not accompany him. My course at once became clear. He was a German, but only a Rhinelander and a commoner, and he was not a potentially dangerous madman. But complying with his suicidal request, I could immediately free myself from one who was no longer a companion, but a menace. I asked him to give me the ivory image before he went, but this request brought from him such uncanny laughter that I did not repeat it. Then I asked him if he wished to leave any keepsake or lock of hair for his family in Germany in case I should be rescued, but again he gave me that strange laugh. So as he climbed the ladder, I went to the levers, and allowing proper time intervals, operated the machinery which sent him to his death. After I saw that he was no longer in the boat, I threw the searchlight around the water in an effort to obtain a last glimpse of him, since I wished to ascertain whether the water pressure would flatten him, as it theoretically should, or whether the body would be unaffected like those extraordinary dolphins. I did not, however, succeed in finding my late companion, for the dolphins were massed thickly and obscuringly about the conning tower. That evening I regretted that I had not taken the ivory image from poor Clance's pocket as he left, for the memory of it fascinated me. I could not forget the youthful, beautiful head with its leafy crown, though I am not by nature an artist. I was also sorry that I had no one with whom to converse. Clance, though not my mental equal, was much better than no one. I did not sleep well that night, and wondered exactly when the end would come. Surely I had little enough chance of rescue. The next day I ascended to the conning tower and commenced the customary searchlight explorations. Northward the view was much the same as it had been all the 4 days since we had sighted the bottom, but I perceived that the drifting of the U-29 was less rapid. As I swung the beam around to the south, I noticed that the ocean floor ahead fell away in a marked declivity and bore curiously regular blocks of stone in certain places, disposed as if in accordance with definite patterns. The boat did not at once descend to match the great ocean depths, so I was soon forced to adjust the searchlight to cast a sharply downward beam. Owing to the abruptness of the change, a wire was disconnected, which necessitated a delay of many minutes for repairs, but at length the light streamed on again, flooding the marine valley below me. I am not given to emotion of any kind, but my amazement was very great when I saw what lay revealed in that electrical glow. And yet, as one reared in the best Kultur of Prussia, I should not have been amazed, for geology and tradition tells us of great transpositions in oceanic and continental areas. What I saw was an extended and elaborate array of ruined edifices, all of magnificent though unclassified architecture, and in various stages of preservation. Most appeared to be of marble, gleaming whitely in the rays of the searchlight, and the general plan was of large city at the bottom of a narrow valley, with numerous isolated temples and villas on the steep slopes above. Roofs were fallen and columns were broken, but there still remained an air of immemorially ancient splendor which nothing could efface. Confronted at last with the Atlantis I had formerly deemed largely a myth, I was the most eager of explorers. At the bottom of that valley a river once had flowed, for as I examined the scene more closely I beheld the remains of stone and marble bridges and sea walls and terraces and embankments once verdant and beautiful. In my enthusiasm I became nearly as idiotic and sentimental as poor Clens, was very tardy in noticing that the southward current had ceased at last, allowing the U-29 to settle slowly down upon the sunken city as an aeroplane settles upon a town of the upper earth. I was slow to realizing that the school of unusual dolphins had vanished. In about 2 hours, the boat rested in a paved plaza close to the rocky wall of the valley. On one side, I could view the entire city as it sloped from the plaza down to the old river bank. On the other side, in startling proximity, I was confronted by the richly ornate and perfectly preserved facade of a great building, evidently a temple, hollowed from the solid rock. Of the original workmanship of this titanic thing, I can only make conjectures. The facade of immense magnitude apparently covers a continuous hollow recess, for its windows are many and widely distributed. In the center yawns a great open door, reached by an impressive flight of steps, and surrounded by exquisite carvings like the figures of bacchanals in relief. Foremost of all are the great columns and frieze, both decorated with sculptures of inexpressible beauty, obviously portraying idealized pastoral scenes and processions of priests and priestesses bearing strange ceremonial devices in adoration of a radiant god. The art is the most phenomenal perfection, largely Hellenic in idea, yet strangely individual. It imparts an impression of terrible antiquity, as though it were the remotest rather than the immediate ancestor of Greek art. Nor can I doubt that every detail of this massive product was fashioned from the virgin hillside rock of our planet. It is palpably a part of the valley wall, though how the vast interior was ever excavated I cannot imagine. Perhaps a cavern or series of caverns furnished the nucleus. Neither age nor submersion had corroded the pristine grandeur of this awful fane, for fane indeed it must be, and today after thousands of years it rests untarnished and inviolate in the endless night and silence of an ocean chasm. I cannot reckon the number of hours I spent in gazing at the sunken city with its building, arches, statues, and bridges, and the colossal temple with its beauty and mystery. Though I knew that death was near, my curiosity was consuming, and I threw the searchlight's beam about in eager quest. The shaft of light permitted me to learn many details, but refused to show anything within the gaping door of the rock-hewn temple, and after a time I turned off the current, conscious of the need of conserving power. The rays were now perceptibly dimmer than they had been during the weeks of drifting, and as if sharpened by the calming deprivation of light, my desire to explore the watery secrets grew. I, a German, should be the first to tread those eon-forgotten ways. I produced and examined a deep-sea diving suit of joined metal and experimented with a portable light and air regenerator. Though I should have trouble in managing the double hatches alone, I believe I could overcome all obstacles with my scientific skill and actually walk about the dead city in person. On August 16th, I effected an exit from the U-29 and laboriously made my way through the ruin and mud-choked streets to the ancient river. I found no skeletons or other human remains, but gleaned a wealth of archaeological lore from sculptures and coins. Of this I cannot now speak save to utter my awe at a culture in the full noon of glory when cave dwellers roamed Europe and then now flowed unwatched to the sea. Others, guided by this manuscript if it shall never be found, must unfold the mysteries at which I can only hint. I returned to the boat as my electric batteries grew feeble, resolved to explore the rock temple on the following days. On the 17th, as my impulse to search out the mystery of the temple waxed still more insistent, a great disappointment befell me, for I found that the materials needed to replenish the portable light had perished in the mutiny of those pigs in July. My rage was unbounded, yet my German sense forbade me to venture unprepared into an utterly black interior, which might prove the lair of some indescribable marine monster, or labyrinth of passages, from whose windings I could never extricate myself. All I could do was to turn on the waning searchlight of the U-29, and with its aid walk up the temple steps and study the exterior carvings. The shaft of light entered the door at an upward angle, and I peered in to see if I could glimpse anything, but all in vain. Not even the roof was visible, and though I took a step or two inside, after testing the floor with the staff, I dared not go further. Moreover, for the first time in my life, I experienced the emotion of dread. I began to realize how some of poor Clenza's moods had arisen, for, as the temple drew me more and more, I feared its aqueous abysses with a blind and mounting terror. Returning to the submarine, I turned off the lights and sat thinking in the dark. Electricity must now be saved for emergencies. Saturday the 18th, I spent in total darkness, tormented by thoughts and memories that threatened to overcome my German will. Clenz had gone mad and perished before reaching this sinister remnant of a past unwholesomely remote, and advised me to go with him. Was indeed fate preserving my reason only to draw me irresistibly to an end more horrible and unthinkable than any man has dreamed of? Clearly my nerves were sorely taxed, and I must cast off these impressions of weaker men. I could not sleep Saturday night, and turned on the lights regardless of the future. It was annoying that the electricity should not last out the air and provisions. I revived my thoughts of euthanasia and examined my automatic pistol. Toward morning I must have dropped asleep with the lights on, for I awoke in darkness yesterday afternoon to find the batteries dead. I struck several matches in succession and desperately regretted the improvidence which had caused us long ago to use up the few candles we carried. After the fading of the last match I dared to waste, I sat very quietly without a light. As I considered the inevitable end, my mind ran over preceding events and developed a hitherto dormant impression which should have caused a weaker and more superstitious man to shudder. The head of the radiant god in the sculptures on the rock temple is the same as the carven bit of ivory which the dead sailor brought from the sea and which poor Clenz carried back into the sea. I was a little dazed by this coincidence, but did not become terrified. It is only the inferior thinker who hastens to explain the singular and the complex by the primitive shortcut of supernaturalism. The coincidence was strange, but I was too sound a reasoner to connect circumstances which admit of no logical connection, or to associate in any uncanny fashion the disastrous events which had led from the Victory affair to my present plight. Feeling the need of more rest, I took a sedative and secured some more sleep. My nervous condition was reflected in my dreams, for I dreamed to hear the cries of drowning persons and to see dead faces pressing against the portholes of the boat, and among the dead faces was the living mocking face of the youth with the ivory image. I must be careful now how I record my waking today, for I am unstrung, and much hallucination is necessarily mixed with fact. Psychologically, my case is most interesting, and I regret that it cannot be observed scientifically by a competent German authority. Upon opening my eyes, my first sensation was an overmastering desire to visit the rock temple, a desire which grew more every insistent, yet which I automatically sought to resist, through some emotion of fear which operated in the reverse direction. Next there came to me the impression of light amidst the darkness of dead batteries, and I seemed to see a sort of phosphorescent glow in the water through the porthole, which opened toward the temple. This aroused my curiosity, for I knew of no deep-sea organism capable of emitting such luminosity. But before I could investigate, there came a third impression, which, because of its irrationality, caused me to doubt the objectivity of anything my senses might record. It was an aural delusion, a sensation of rhythmic, melodic sound, as of some wild yet beautiful chant, or choral hymn, coming from the outside through the absolutely soundproof hull of the U-29. Convinced of my psychological and nervous abnormality, I lighted some matches and poured a stiff dose of sodium bromide solution, which seemed to calm me to the extent of dispelling the illusion of sound. But the phosphorescence remained, and I had difficulty in repressing a childish impulse to go to the porthole and seek its source. It was horribly realistic, and I could soon distinguish by its aid the familiar objects around me, as well as the empty sodium bromide glass of which I had no form of visual impression in its present location. This last circumstance made me ponder, and I crossed the room and touched the glass. It was indeed in the place where I had seemed to see it. Now I knew that the light was either real or part of hallucination, so fixed and consistent that I could not hope to dispel it. So abandoning all resistance, I ascended to the conning tower to look for the luminous agency. Might it not actually be another U-boat offering possibilities of rescue? It is well that the reader accepts nothing which follows as objective truth, for since the events transcend natural law, they are necessarily the subjective and unreal creations of my overtaxed mind. When I attained the coming tower, I found the sea in general far less luminous than I had expected. There was no animal or vegetable phosphorescence about, and that the city that sloped down to the river was invisible in blackness. What I did see was not spectacular, not grotesque or terrifying, yet it removed my last vestige of trust in my consciousness, for the doors and windows of the undersea temple, hewn from the rocky hill, were vividly aglow with a flickering radiance as from a mighty altar flame far within. Later incidents are chaotic. As I stared at the uncannily lighted door and windows, I became subject to the most extravagant visions, visions so extravagant that I cannot even relate them. I fancied that I had discerned objects in the temple, objects both stationary and moving, and it seemed to hear again the unreal chant that had floated to me when I first woke, and over all those rose thoughts and fears was entered in the youth from the sea and the ivory image whose carvings was duplicated on the frieze and columns of the temple before me. I thought of poor Clens, and wondered where his body rested with the image he had carried back into the sea. He had warned me of something, and I had not heeded. But he was a soft-headed Rhinelander, who went mad at troubles a Prussian could bear with ease. The rest is very simple. My impulse to visit and into the temple has now become an inexplicable and imperious command, which ultimately cannot be denied. My own German will no longer controls my acts, and volition is henceforward possible only in minor matters. Such madness it was which drove Clens to his death, bareheaded and unprotected, in the ocean. But I am a Prussian and a man of sense, and will use to the last what little will I have. When first I saw that I must go, I prepared my diving suit, helmet, and air regenerator for instant donning, and immediately commenced to write this hurried chronicle in the hope that it may some day reach the world. I shall seal the manuscript in a bottle and trust it to the sea as I leave the U-29 forever. I have no fear, not even from the prophecies of the madman Clens. What I have seen cannot be true, and I know that this madness of my own will at most lead only to suffocation when air is gone. The light in the temple is a sheer delusion, and I shall die calmly like a German in the black and forgotten depths. This demonic laughter which I hear as I write comes only from my weakening brain, so I will carefully don my diving suit and walk boldly up the steps into that primal shrine, that silent secret of unfathomed waters and uncounted years.